I haven't said anything yet. And you're clapping. Whoa. High expectations. Okay. So the topic this afternoon is how Martin Luther transformed marriage and family life. I hope people at the back can read this. Oh, good. Several years ago, I attended a talk at Wellesley College by Marilyn Yalom, who is an alumni of Wellesley and also, and the author of the book, The History of the Wife. During the question and answer following the talk, someone asked Yalom what part of her research she found most surprising. Without hesitation, she replied, the role of Martin Luther in raising the position of marriage and the wife. She went on to say that as a Jew, she was not predisposed to like Martin Luther, who sadly became very anti-Semitic toward the end of his life. However, her research led her to write, few people influenced the institution of marriage more than the Augustinian monk Martin Luther. Yalom joins Stephanie Kuntz and a host of other scholars who trace the celebration of married love and companionship to the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, and very particularly to the writings and surprising marriage of Martin Luther. The history of love and marriage in the West is a fascinating one. How did we come from the commonly accepted 12th and 13th century belief that romantic love has no place in marriage to the contemporary view that love is all you need? I've done 3 lectures on this topic, and I will not repeat them today, tonight, this afternoon, whatever it is. But we will be looking at Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation as a critical turning point where love and marriage were first spoken of in the same sentence. Here's my outline. So in order to answer the question how Martin Luther transformed marriage, we have to look at marriage before Martin Luther. What did he protest and reform? I'll mention 2 areas. First, the medieval Catholic Church's dualism, which exalted spirit and mind over body, and for that reason celebrated the state of celibacy as far superior to marriage. And second, the medieval understanding of romantic love as intrinsically incompatible with marriage and children. To illustrate both of these, I'm going to start by telling you the true story of 2 12th century lovers. One scholar writes that the story of Eloise and Abelard still has the shock value of a romance come horror story. But it's true. Denis de Rougemont describes Abelard and Eloise as the earliest passionate lovers whose story has reached us through an abundance of courtly poems and letters. Abelard met Eloise in Paris in 1118 when he was 37 years old and a well-known celebrity master of theology. She was probably 15 and living with her uncle Fulbert, who was a church canon and who was zealous for her scientific and literary education. To gain access to her, Abelard asked if he might live in Fulbert's house in exchange for tutoring his niece. With enormous self-confidence, Abelard plotted and succeeded in seducing Eloise. Had she resisted, as her teacher, he had the right to physically chastise her to make her bend to his will. But that turned out to be unnecessary. Eloise was totally smitten and wrote of him, "What country, what town, what city did not simmer with excitement to see you? What married woman, what unmarried woman did not desire you in your absence and not burn in your presence?" During their passionate love affair, Abelard's teaching suffered and Eloise got pregnant. Her uncle insisted that Abelard marry her, and he agreed, but wanted the marriage to be secret, since according to canon law, he would not be allowed to continue teaching philosophy and theology if it was known that he was married. But after their son was born, Eloise objected to marrying because of the commonly held belief that family life was incompatible with the life of a scholar. As Abelard put it later, "What person, absorbed by religious and philosophic meditations, could endure the crying of newborn babies, the songs of their nurses to quiet them, the noisy crowd of servants? What disgust in having to bear the continual filth of little children." Eloise preferred to be called Abelard's friend, sister, and lover, even his concubine or courtesan, rather than ruin his career by becoming his wife. However, they did marry secretly to honor her uncle's wishes, but they lived separately. Soon after, her uncle Fulbert began to beat Eloise, and Abelard abducted her and placed her in an abbey for safety. Fulbert took revenge. With the help of a friend, he overpowered Abelard in his sleep and castrated him. Abelard believed that this was God's judgment for his sexual sin, so he withdrew to a cloister as a celibate cleric and ordered that Eloise become a nun permanently. Both of them donned the clerical habit the same day. She was probably 17. He was 39. They were legally married, and there was no outside obstacle preventing them from living together as man and wife. Yet, Eloise and Abelard never saw each other again. Abelard lived another 24 years as a monk, writer, teacher, and founder of the Abbey of Paraclet, in which, ironically, Eloise would eventually attain the rank of abbess. Eloise wrote Abelard two impassioned, erotic love letters reproaching him for abandoning her. Abelard never replied. He died in 1144, and she died 20 years later and was buried beside her husband. I have no idea what became of their child. Children didn't fit very well into their narrative of romantic love. How can we explain this bizarre story of tortured love? Early medieval Catholicism, with its embracing of Greek dualism, is largely responsible. During the early Middle Ages, the Catholic Church gradually took over the jurisdiction of marriage. Catholic teaching carried on the tradition of the most ascetic of the 4th-century church fathers, who'd been strongly influenced by Platonic dualism, which denigrated the body, especially sex, in contrast to spirit and mind. They taught that there was a radical disjunction between spiritual vocations, like the priesthood, and teaching theology, and secular vocations, including marriage and family life. The surest way to salvation for men and women, boys and girls, was to enter a monastery or convent and take a vow of celibacy. Ever since the Council of Nicaea in 325, the church had tried and largely failed to enforce celibacy on the clergy. Throughout the 11th and 12th century, popes and church councils continued to condemn clerical marriage. But in the early Middle Ages, a significant number of priests lived with concubines, and some were even officially married. Most parishioners apparently accepted these relationships, but marriage disqualified clergy from rising in the church hierarchy. The church also taught that the only purpose of sexual relations was procreation, and that enjoyment of sex was strongly denounced as sinful. Lives of the saints, sung or recited, extolled those, unmarried as well as married, who had taken vows of chastity. For example, the life of Saint Alexius, written around 1050, told the story of a man's ascension to sainthood, which began when he abandoned his wife on their wedding night and fled to live in poverty. A 12th century German manuscript, which I will hopefully show you, 12th century German manuscript represents three levels of Christian womanhood. Virgins are at the top, widows in the middle, and wives are at the bottom. They're shown gathering sheaves of wheat, which represent their heavenly reward. The women are judged by their sexual activity. So virgins have the most sheaves, the most heavenly rewards, and wives have the least. Widows are in the middle. Within this framework, or the framework of this female spiritual hierarchy, wives could become holy women and achieve high religious status by taking vows of chastity, especially if they could persuade their husbands to join them. The Book of Marjorie Kempe is the autobiography of a well-born Englishwoman born in 1373, who at the age of 20 married a man of lower social status. They were happily married, and she described her husband as a tender and compassionate man. After the birth of her first child, she experienced some kind of postpartum emotional breakdown and was eventually delivered by a vision of Christ. Her continued mystical experiences led her to an abhorrence for sexual intercourse. So she said to her husband, and she, I'm quoting from her autobiography, which she sometimes writes in the third person, goes in and out of first to third person. So she said to her husband, "I may not deny you my body, But all the love and affection of my heart is withdrawn from all earthly creatures and set on God alone. But he would have his way with her, and she obeyed with much weeping and sorrowing. And often she advised her husband to live chaste and said that they had often displeased God by their inordinate love and the great delight each of them had in using the other's body. And now it would be a good thing if by mutual consent they punished and chastised themselves by abstaining from the lust of their bodies. Close quote. After a great deal of negotiation with her husband, including her promising to pay off his debts, they both made a formal vow of chastity before the Bishop of Lincoln. Marjorie Kempe was 40 years old by then and had 14 children. She spent the rest of her life going on pilgrimages and writing about her spiritual journey with no mention of her 14 children. Marjorie Kempe was not the only wife to choose the holy life that Marilyn Yalom writes. The medieval worldview that prized celibacy above marriage and motherhood allowed these wives to convince their husbands to let them embrace a religious vocation, which included vows of chastity and the abandonment of their children. The Platonic dualistic teaching of the medieval church goes a long way in explaining why Eloise and Abelard could not reconcile the mundaneness of marriage and family life with the work of a cleric and scholar. It also explains Abelard's self-punishing masochism, not to mention his cruelty to Eloise in refusing to live with the wife he loved and who loved him. Sexual passion, even in marriage, was considered sinful. It's strangely fitting that Abelard and Eloise's lives coincided with what scholars call the birth of romantic love. Denis de Rougemont even dates what he calls the rebirth of Eros to 1118, the year Abelard and Eloise met for the first time, and the century in which love was first recognized as a passion worth cultivating. So I'll speak now a bit about the birth of romantic love. It's obviously that romantic love and attraction have existed in all times and places. What else could the writer of Proverbs be referring to when he marvels at the way of a man with a maid, with a young woman? He says it's a mystery too wonderful for him, something that he does not understand. Romantic love is universal and, yes, mysterious. But cultural conditioning plays an enormous part in its meaning and expression. I'll be speaking now about a very particular form of romantic love, which began in Europe in the 12th century French aristocratic courts and has profoundly impacted Western culture ever since. It was called courtly love and was made fashionable and spread by the songs and poets of troubadours. From its birth, this kind of romantic love was emphatically not considered a basis for marriage. As Andreas Capellanus wrote in The Art of Courtly Love, everybody knows that love can have no place between a husband and wife. 12th and 3rd century advice literature on the art of love exalted adulterous or inaccessible passion. Its model was the perfect knight and the inaccessible idealized lady, usually the wife of a king. Think Lancelot and Queen Guinevere, who was the wife of King Arthur. It could either be sexually unconsummated or adulterous. Richard de Fourneval, the physician to the King of France in the 13th century, described love as a folly of the mind, an unquenchable fire, a hunger without surfeit, an agreeable illness, a sweet delight, a pleasing madness. While gender roles prescribe that men do the pursuing and women be pursued, books like Robert Dubois' Advice to Ladies taught married women how to excite desire in men who were not their husbands, while remaining faithful to their marriage vows. While treatises and books on love addressed only the elite, a popular genre of song among the lower classes took up the theme of the love triangle. Unhappy wives married to older, abusive men, but attracted to younger, attractive, kind lovers. In his book, Love in the Western World, Denis de Rougemont writes that love, defined by this tradition, feeds on obstacles, short excitations, and partings. It is unstable, and though it may overcome many obstacles, it almost always fails at one, and that is the obstacle constituted by time. This is why it is incompatible with marriage. an institution set up to be lasting, no matter what time brings along, including all the regular unromantic chores like taking out the garbage, changing diapers, caring for sick children in the middle of the night, the challenges of aging, economic losses, accidents, hurricanes, plagues, serious illnesses, and finally, death. Derusma argues that romantic love, as defined by this tradition, is also incompatible with happiness. It is more in love with love, with passion, and with being in love than with the beloved. It is intrinsically unfulfillable because its fire is only kept burning by obstacles. It often ends in tragedy and death, as in the myth of Tristan and Isolde, the story of Romeo and Juliet, Anna Karenina, Madame Bovary, Elvira Madigan, Heathcliff and Kathy in Wuthering Heights, Dr. Zhivago. The list goes on. Romantic love, or eros, so defined, differs dramatically from Christian love, agape, which is active love of your neighbor as yourself. Marriages do not survive without large daily doses of agape love. If de Rougemont is correct, the cultivation of romantic love began in Europe as an upper-class reaction against Christianity, and in particular its doctrine of marriage, which was felt to be too restrictive and had become an object of scorn and contempt. These ideas came from people who, though nominally Christian, were actually still pagan in their spirits. Moving on now to Martin Luther's protest. So this is what came before, what I've just described. On October 31st in 1517, Martin Luther posted his 95 theses on the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church, protesting the Catholic Church's practice of selling indulgences to procure remission of sin. He insisted that the Bible, not the Pope, was the only authority for Christians, and that salvation was available by grace alone, through faith alone, to anyone who repented and believed in Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of their sins. Luther's protest against the Pope and the Church ignited a firestorm throughout Europe as princes, electors, provinces, cities, and states converted to Lutheranism or to another form of Protestantism. Stephanie Kuntz writes, "The papacy's thousand-year monopoly over Christian doctrine was destroyed, and one of the central disputes between Catholics and Protestants was over the role of marriage." Rejecting Greek dualism that idealized virginity, Luther argued from Scripture in letters and tracts against the Church's insistence on the celibacy of priests. He pointed out that Peter was an apostle and married, and that there's no suggestion in the New Testament that church leaders should not marry. In fact, 1 Timothy says that forbidding of marriage is described as a doctrine of demons. Marriage is a glorious estate established by God at creation, not a necessary evil, which was the Catholic teaching, or in any way inferior to celibacy. In fact, Luther would argue that marriage and family life were a much surer context for growth in character and holiness than a monastery could ever be. Luther concluded his 1520 open letter to the Christian nobility of the German nation with these assertions. First, not every priest can do without a woman, not only on account of the weakness of the flesh, but more because of the necessities of the household. Second, the Pope has as little power to command this as he has to forbid eating, drinking, the natural movement of the bowels, or growing fat. Elsewhere, he explained that sex was a natural desire and that those without the gift of celibacy should marry, including the many clergy who were living with concubines and parenting children with them. Otherwise, they would either be tormented by desire or commit sexual sin, and marriage was a purer state than either of those alternatives. Third, although the law of the Pope is against it, nevertheless, when the estate of matrimony has been entered against the Pope's law, then his law is at an end, is no longer valid. For the commandment of God, which decrees that no one shall put man and wife asunder, takes precedent over the law of the Pope. In another treatise written 2 years later, Luther argued for the created naturalness of marital sex in both women and men. He wrote, "The beginning of children is as deeply implanted in our nature as eating and drinking. Whoever wants to repudiate this and fight what nature will and must do acts the same as one who disavows that nature is nature that fire burns, that water is wet, and that a person eats, drinks, and sleeps. Close quote. In 1520, Luther, along with other reformers, rejected the Catholic dogma that made marriage a sacrament. But he insisted on the importance of marriage and recommended it to everyone, to priests and laymen alike. The reformers also believed there is no biblical warrant for monasteries and convents, and where they had jurisdiction, they closed them down. So, in spite of all Luther's arguments in favor of marriage, he actually had no intention of marrying. When the female Bavarian reformer and writer Argula von Grumbach challenged him to practice what he preached and find a wife, he replied that he was unwed, quote, not because I'm a sexless log or stone, but because I daily expect to be burned at the stake as a heretic. And he had good reason to fear that. He had good reason to fear that. Once he had declared, I cannot and I will not retract anything, for it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience, here I stand. Once he stated that, Luther was charged with high treason, and he became the most wanted man in Europe. Both the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor, the two most powerful men in Europe, wanted him dead. So what made him change his mind and decide to get married? Now I must back up a little and introduce you to Katharina von Bora. Katharina was born in 1499 into an impoverished aristocratic family. Her father had the status of a knight, but with the breakup of the knighthood, he was living as a gentleman farmer. When she was 6 years old, her mother died and her father remarried and sent Katharina to a Benedictine boarding school. When she was 10, her father moved her to a more austere and less expensive Cistercian Marienthron convent, where she was consecrated as a nun at age 16. An ascetic life, including vows of obedience, poverty, chastity, and silence for much of the time, promised salvation for cloistered girls. And many preferred it to the risk of being forced by their parents into a loveless, potentially abusive marriage. Married women also faced the ever-present threat of death in childbirth. And as I mentioned earlier, it was more prestigious to be a virgin nun than to be a wife. But Catherine was not content. She was spiritually hungry. She did not have access to the Bible, but only to Psalms and to those scripture passages included in the Office of the Hours. And in the early 1520s, some of Luther's forbidden writings were somehow smuggled into the convent. The nuns at Marienthron were especially moved by Luther's condemnations of monastery vows. He wrote that those vows were not based on the word of God and were contrary to faith, to Christian freedom, to God's commandments, and to reason. He wrote, "It is obvious that such human commandments, such as forbidding marriages of priests, are nothing but dictates of mere humans and the devil. How wrong it is that the nobility tempts their daughters and sisters to become nuns, yes, even pushes them into cloisters, if they want to or not, only so the lineage and class not be impaired and impoverished. So, if you have a daughter or friend who has fallen into such an estate, and you are sincere and faithful, you should help to get her out, even if you have to risk your goods, body, and life for it. If nuns are in the cloister unwillingly, they are forced to suffer greatly, having hell on earth as well as in the future." Close quote. Several nuns, including Katharina, were convinced and wrote to their parents asking for help to leave the convent. For a number of reasons, their parents all refused. Many were poor and had already paid the convent to bring up their daughters. Secondly, in order to leave a monastery, you needed a papal dispensation, and that involved a lengthy process and a lot of money. And third, the Marienthron convent was in the territory of Duke George of Saxony, who was a violent enemy of the Reformation. And it was a capital offense to be caught helping a nun escape. When their families could not or would not help them, the nuns smuggled a letter to Luther, asking for his help. After all, it was his pamphlet that convinced them. Luther's friend Leonard Kopp was a merchant who frequently delivered goods to Marienthron, and he agreed to hide the nuns among some empty herring barrels in his covered wagon and deliver them to Wittenberg. 12 nuns renounced their vows and left the convent on Easter Sunday early in the morning, 1523. It was a dangerous journey through warring countryside. Three returned to their parents, and nine continued on to the Augustinian monastery at Wittenberg, where Luther was a monk and professor of biblical theology. This may well have been the first independent decision that these young women had made, and it was very risky. But they were apparently very happy to be free. All they brought with them was the clothes on their back, their white habit. A Wittenberg student wrote to a friend, "A few days ago, a wagon load of Vestal virgins came to town, more eager for wedlock than for life. God grant them husbands before they fare worse." Having helped the nuns escape, Luther now felt responsible to find husbands or suitable positions for the nuns. In the end, all were provided for except Katharina von Bora. While living in the home of a Wittenberg family, she met and fell in love with a man who had spoke to her of marriage. But because of her poverty, his family pressured him to marry someone else, leaving her with a broken heart. So Luther chose for her Dr. Glatz. But Katharina found him odious and refused to marry him on any terms. Then she sought out Luther's good friend, Dr. Nicholas von Amsdorf, and asked him to tell Luther that she would be willing to marry Amsdorf or Luther himself. After a period of reflection and prayer, Luther decided to accept Kate's proposal. He wrote that his marriage would please his father, who wanted progeny, rile the Pope, cause the angels to laugh and the devils to weep. It would also, I think I agree with Mike, if I was going to go have a beer in a pub, I would choose Luther over Calvin. Anyway, after a period of, yes, I read that already, Roland Bainton writes, "The most unpremeditated and dramatic witness to Luther's principles was his own marriage." Another Luther scholar wrote that Luther's marriage was a genuine and far more offensive form of iconoclasm, or idol breaker, against the false saintliness of the charismatic ascetic who forsakes all things worldly. For Luther, to be saintly meant to be near his dear housewife and to be her lover now. It meant God allows us to laugh and embrace our wives, whether naked or clothed. That was saintliness for Luther, in contrast to the ascetics who left the wife, St. Alexius, who left his wife on the wedding day to go live in a cloister. There they are. So I'm going to talk now about Martin and Katharina's marriage and the cultivation and growth of love. In 1525, at age 42, Luther married 26-year-old Katharina von Bora. In their wedding invitation, Martin and Kate emphasized that their marriage was an act of confession and obedience to God's plan of salvation. Sorry, of creation. Plan of creation. Martin and Katharina's marriage did not begin as a love match. Luther wrote that he decided to marry Kate out of compassion, a German word which he described as caring for your neighbor's problems as if they were your own, taking them to heart. And Kate chose Luther because she saw in him the liberator and knew no other person she could trust so completely. But getting to know Luther as he really was awakened in Katharina a love that was similar to Martin's feeling of compassion. Once married, Martin and Kate came to love each other deeply. Luther wrote, "I am not infatuated, but I cherish my wife. And I would not exchange Katie for France or for Venice for three reasons. One, because God has given her to me and me to her. Two, because I've seen time and again that other women have more faults than my Kate. Three, she's a faithful marriage partner, she is loyal, and she has integrity." He wrote that, of course, a Christian should love his wife. He is bound to love his neighbor as himself. His wife is his nearest neighbor. Therefore, she should be his dearest friend. The greatest grace of God is when love persists in marriage. The couple should study to be pleasing to each other. The first love is drunken. When the intoxication wears off, then comes the real marriage love. Union of flesh does nothing by itself. There must also be a union of manners, which that word meant morals, closer to morals in his day, and mind. Katie, you have a husband that loves you. One of his highest compliments to Kate was when Martin compared her to his favorite epistle, the book of Galatians. He wrote, "I trust it. I trust the book of Galatians. It is my Kate von Bora." Unfortunately, few of Kate's letters have survived, so most of what we know about her comes from what others, especially Martin, wrote about her. But shortly after his death, she wrote to her sister-in-law, "Dearly beloved sister, I truly thank you for the cordial sympathy you extended to me and my poor children. For who could not truly mourn and grieve for such a dear man as my beloved husband has been, who was of service not only to one town or one country, but to the whole world." Think now about the Luther household. When Martin and Kate married, they moved into the Black Cloister, which became their parsonage. It was the Augustinian monastery where Martin had lived as a monk and where the monks had worn black robes. That's why it was called the Black Cloister. In 1532, the Elector Johann of Saxony officially transferred ownership of the property to Martin and Katharina and their heirs. It was a gift in gratitude for Luther's teaching, preaching, and tireless work to spread the word of God. Marriage brought major adjustments to husband and wife. Luther wrote, "Before I married, the bed of straw was not made for a whole year and became foul with sweat. But I worked so hard and was so weary, I tumbled in without noticing it." I think Katharina noticed it, did something about it. He also wrote, "When one wakes up in the morning and finds a pair of pigtails on the pillow, which were not there before." Martin also learned that he must take seriously his wife's wishes and fears. And so he agreed to cancel travel plans to attend a friend's wedding because of her strong fears that he might encounter violence from the peasant wars. Justified fears. It was a huge task to make the Black Cloister livable. With the help of a maid, Katharina set to work repairing the rundown monastery. They lined and whitewashed walls and cleaned rooms. Katharina installed an indoor bathroom and created a brewery. Gradually, with a huge amount of work, she made the Black Cloister self-sustaining. She grew vegetables and fruit, raised, milked, slaughtered, and sold cows, and made butter and cheese. She raised hens, ducks, and pigs. She was a fisher, a brewer, cattle and horse breeder, a beekeeper, and a vintner. And they were hospitable. Katharina ran a household that at times included more than 40 people. The Luther's 6 children, 2 of whom died, servants, 6 or 7 orphaned nieces and nephews, 4 children of a widowed friend, tutors for the children, Kate's aunt, Martin's student boarders, friends and family members, and sick folks in need of Kate's nursing skills. On top of the regulars, guests from all over the world found their way to Luther House, including Protestant refugees, displaced scholars, and escaped nuns and monks. Their practice of hospitality began on their wedding night. At 11 p.m., after the guests left, a man fleeing from the peasant war showed up at their door asking for shelter, and they took him in. I'm going to talk now about table talk, or in Libri lingo, discussion meals. Meals in the Luther household were times of lively conversation. Luther often started the discussion by asking, "What news do you hear?" or "What's new in the country?" The Markwolds write, "The Luther table was one of the best news-gathering systems in the land. Visitors from princes to itinerant students, foreign envoys and unemployed schoolmasters, poor widows, ousted preachers, escaped monks and freed nuns, Englishmen and Frenchmen, Bohemians and Hungarians, Africans, relatives and friends all sat at Katharina's table for a day, a week, or a year. News of the whole continent was funneled through Luther House. Kate decided how many could be accommodated, and she was in charge of the seating order. There was often a waiting list of people who wanted room and board at Luther House. And if they were full, Martin wrote, "If a vacancy occurs, I will gladly notify you if Lord Kate will then give me her gracious permission." Martin's student boarders saw it as an educational opportunity, and they jotted down everything their professor said. After Luther's death, they published it as Table Talk, which includes 6,596 entries on every conceivable topic, ranging, in Roland Bainton's words, from the ineffable majesty of God the Omnipotent to the frogs in the Elbe. Pigs, popes, pregnancies, politics, and proverbs jostle one another in Table Talk. Bainton includes in his biography of Luther a contemporary print of the Luther household at table. Under the print, he wrote, "There is an unpardonable omission in this print. Katie is not there." Martin encouraged, even expected, his wife to contribute to the conversation. And we know from Table Talk that she did. She listened, she asked questions, she supported, and she challenged. She sometimes scolded Luther for his angry or indignant responses to his guests. During the period of 1540, more than 40 residents of Luther House were sick at the same time. Kate had learned nursing skills from her aunt, who had been head of the infirmary at the convent. She knew how to use herbs, massages, compresses, and special diets to treat many ailments, including her husband's. Now a word about the Luther's finances. One of Katharina's greatest challenges was to bring some order to the Luther finances. Martin was a terrible manager of money and much more generous than he could afford to be. Though he often chafed against it, he was dependent on his wife's frugality and business sense. He didn't charge students for his lectures or for their board until Katie insisted, and he accepted no honoraria for all of his publications. He once wrote, "God put fingers on our hand for the money to slide through so that he can give us more. Whatever a person gives away, God will reimburse." He was, as one scholar says, irritatingly blithe about debts, saying, "I do not worry about debts, because when Katie pays one, another comes." It's not surprising that they had frequent disagreements over money. With Martin's policy of unbridled generosity and both of their compassion for refugees, poor students, and homeless people, the Luthers often found themselves in debt. And Kate is the one who had to face the angry butcher and other merchants when she couldn't pay them. Luther admitted, "I have a peculiar budget. I consume more than I take in. What am I to do?" He finally agreed, at Kate's urging, to take stock of their finances. He described the result as, quote, "a peculiar calculation held between Dr. Martin and Kate," unquote. Gradually, Kate was able to rein in her husband's spending and make Luther House self-sustaining by, among other things, asking those students and guests who were able to pay for their room and board. She was unfairly criticized for this and accused of being a stingy miser by people who were used to freeloading off the Luthers. But the number of students and guests increased, and Martin compared Kate to the noble wife of Proverbs 31, in whom her husband could trust and confide. Luther's biographer Roland Bainton wrote that Kate's greatest victory was that she taught her husband to say no. Luther frequently called her Dominus, my lord, or Lord Kate, and jokingly changed her name Kathy to Kette, the German word for chain. At times, he seemed uncomfortable with her authority over the household, but he also said, "In domestic affairs, I defer to Katie. Otherwise, I'm led by the Holy Ghost." Martin's letters to Kate. He wrote her lots of letters when he was traveling, which was frequently. His respect, appreciation, and affection for Kate, as well as his humor, are evident in the way he addressed her in his many letters. They also give you a sense of the many hats that she wore. So I'm going to just read you a few examples. "To my dear Lord, Mrs. Katharina Luther at Wittenberg, personally. To my most beloved lady of the house, dear Lord Kate, to my sweetheart in person, to my friendly and dear lady of the house, Katharina von Bora Luther, a preacher, beer brewer, gardener, and whatever other talent she may have. To my dearly beloved lady of the house, Katharina Luther, Mrs. Doctor, Lady of Zulsdorf, of the pig market, and whatever else she might be. To my highly learned wife, Katharina Luther, my gracious lady of the house at Wittenberg. To my holy worrying lady, Katharina Luther, Doctor, Lady of Zulsdorf at Wittenberg, my gracious beloved lady of the house. The reference to Zulsdorf is where actually a farm that he bought where she raised pigs. And the reference to her worrying, being the worrying lady, is that she frequently worried about his health and his safety when he was traveling. For good reason, he actually died while he was away from home traveling, quite unexpectedly. The plague. In 1527, there was an outbreak of the plague in Wittenberg, during which time Kate gave birth to a daughter, their second child, Elizabeth. Many fled the city, but the Luthers stayed and turned Luther House into a hospital. In an open letter, "Whether One May Flee from a Deadly Plague," Luther wrote, quote, "First, one has to submit quietly to God, trusting in his love and goodness. Then staying put and not fleeing from the plague or any disaster is to be praised because it is a sign of strong faith. And Matthew 25:34 following teaches that all Christians are linked together, so we cannot desert anyone in need, but are duty-bound to help him or her in the same way as we would want this person to help us in our exigencies. If a city or country has a hospital, that is fine and good. But if not, then people's residences have to become infirmaries, and by God's grace, each neighbor must become a caregiver and nurse for the suffering ones." In closing, Luther wrote, "We must say to the devil, get out of my way with your scaring. In defiance of you, I will help my sick neighbor and know that it is pleasing to God and to his angels. Since Christ has shed his blood for me and died for me, how can I not, for his sake, place myself into this small danger of a powerless pestilence? Say, Satan, if you frighten me, Christ will give me courage. If you kill me, Christ will give me life." It was during the plague that Luther wrote the wonderful classic hymn, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." Looking back on that time, in a 1539 sermon, Luther said, "We did not flee. I am your preacher and visitor of the sick, and Kate is a nurse, doctor, pharmacist, counselor, etc. God has protected Kate and me and our whole family from two plagues. We have been blessed in this city in good days. Why should we leave when suffering strikes?" Caring for Martin was a formidable task for Kate. He was frequently sick with gout, asthma, breathing difficulties, kidney stones, ear infections, dizzy spells, sciatica, every kind of GI tract problem. I won't go into those details. Mike did last night, talking about the scatological side of German life and of his writing, and other ailments. He had anxiety attacks and serious bouts of depression. Kate used all of her nursing skills to help her husband. At one point he wrote, "I often lie next to my Catherine, truly a woman worthy to be loved, when I am worried and fearful and bathed in a cold sweat." Once, when Kate was not able to counsel him out of a depression, she put on a black dress. He asked, "Are you going to a funeral?" She replied, "No. But since you act as though God is dead, I wanted to join you in the mourning." Her novel approach helped, and he recovered from that depression. Another time, he got so involved in writing that he locked himself in a room with no food. He would not respond to her knocking and pleading. So after 3 days, she got a locksmith to come and open his study door. In another version of the story, she actually had the door removed. Perhaps it was another occasion. It could have been. Kate frequently visited Martin in his study to encourage his writing, which he believed was a major part of his vocation. And surely it was. Think of the volume of books that Mike showed us last night that this man wrote. The printing press was a recent invention, and the Wittenberg printer was looking for a popular writer. Without Martin knowing it, the printer published his 95 theses, which were distributed as far as Spain in no time. Luther had no idea that was happening. He became the first European bestseller. He wrote 130 books, which amounted to one quarter of all the books that were sold in Europe at the time. Among all of her other duties, Kate supervised the printing and distribution of her husband's prolific writing. Martin also encouraged her to learn scripture and promised to give her 50 gulden, a sum of money which he did not have, if she would read through the whole Bible in a year. They discussed and often argued over passages of the Bible together, and he had her memorize Psalm 31, anticipating her need for the comfort of his favorite psalm if she were to be widowed, which she was. His dying words were those of Psalm 31, verse 5. Into thy hand I commit my spirit. Thou hast redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. Martin was so devoted to Kate and dependent on her that he sometimes worried that he gave more credit to Catherine than to Christ, who has done so much more for me. Now we talk about children. On October 21st, 1526, Luther told a friend, Kate is fulfilling Genesis 3, verse 8. When the news of her pregnancy got about town, many saw it as a sacrilege and predicted that the union of a monk and a nun, who had both broken their vows of chastity, could only produce a two-headed monster or even the Antichrist. But when Hans was born, Luther rejoiced. I am a fortunate husband. The best and dearest wife has presented me with a son, Johannes Lutherlein, little Luther. Thanks be to God. I have become a father by the wonderful grace of God. Martin and Kate shared the view that children are the sweetest fruits of marriage. They tie and strengthen the bonds of love. Their second child, Elizabeth, was born during the plague and lived only 8 months. Both parents were heartbroken by her death. They wrote to a friend, "She left us behind, deeply saddened and weak. Before this tragedy, we did not perceive that a father and mother could be so moved by the death of their child." And in another letter, they wrote, "We feel a great sadness, for with Elfstein died a piece of her father's and a part of her mother's heart." The Luthers had four more children, Magdalena, Martin, Paul, and Margaret. Tragically, Magdalena died at age 13 or 14 in her father's arms. He could not reconcile the fact that he knew she was at peace and all was well with the sorrow and grief that overwhelmed he and Kate. Neither parent ever really got over Lenchen's death, though they were comforted knowing she was with Jesus. Luther tried to comfort other grieving people, saying that he understood their sorrows, for he never stopped missing his daughter. Martin and Katrina's attitude toward their children and domestic life could not have differed more from the attitude of Eloise and Abelard. There was nothing unspiritual about raising children that made it incompatible with teaching theology. With a powerful grasp on the goodness of God's creation, the reformers repudiated the split between sacred and secular. They saw all of life, including every vocation, as spiritual, except for sin, which could affect any vocation. Luther was intensely aware of the unseen world, of God, of angels, of demons, and so on. And he saw God's wisdom and truth in all of life. Watching his infant son, Martin, at Kate's breast, he remarked, "This child has as enemies the Pope, bishops, Duke George, Emperor Ferdinand, and all the devils. Yet, he is not afraid of any of them, but rather sucks away with joy. He doesn't care about his enemies. He is of good cheer. He lets them be angry as long as they want to be. Indeed, Christ said, become like little children." On another occasion, commenting on the same biblical text, he looked at his family and said, "Christ said we must become as little children to enter the kingdom of heaven. Dear God, this is too much. Have we got to become such idiots?" Luther thoroughly enjoyed his children. He wrote of his first baby, "Hans is cutting his teeth and making a joyous nuisance of himself. These are the joys of marriage of which the Pope is not worthy." On another occasion, he asked, "Child, what have you done that I should love you so? what with your befouling the corners of the house and bawling through the whole place, I wouldn't exchange you for all the kingdoms of Europe. Martin hung out diapers to the neighbor's amusement. His response was, let them laugh. God and the angels smile in heaven. After being married, Luther came to believe and teach that due to the exacting nature of family life, it was a far better training ground for character, daily patience, love, fortitude, and humility than a monastery could ever be. Husbands worried how to provide for their families. Wives endured the dangers of pregnancy and childbirth. And raising children was a daily trial for both parents. And there are what he also called the vexations between the married couple. Good God, he exclaimed, what a lot of trouble there is in marriage. Adam has made a mess of our nature. Think of all the squabbles Adam and Eve must have had in the course of their 900 years. Martin and Kate were both strong personalities and had frequent disagreements over money and household policy and sometimes over interpretations of scripture. And while she always addressed him respectfully as doctor, she did not hesitate to rebuke him, especially for his crude remarks about other people, or to interrupt him to say, doctor, why don't you stop talking and eat? He was clearly quite a talker and writer. At one point, he exclaimed, oh, if I were to court a girl again, I would chisel myself an obedient wife from a rock. The daily demands of their work led to conflicting felt needs in the evening. At the end of a busy day with children, servants, cooking, gardening, and animals, Kate would want to sit and talk with her husband as an equal. But he, exhausted from preaching, lecturing, and discussion meals with students, would want to sink into a chair and lose himself in a book. He exclaimed, all my life is patience. I have to be patient with the Pope, with the heretics, with my family, and with Katie. But he realized that patience was a necessary Christian virtue and that it was very good for him. In this last section, I want to talk about Luther's egalitarianism. With respect to marital gender roles, Luther was a child of his time, at least in theory. However, as with other reformers, in practice, his marriage frequently contradicted his belief in wifely subordination. So he is famous for having said, men have broad shoulders and narrow hips, and accordingly, they possess intelligence. Women have narrow shoulders and broad hips. Women ought to stay at home. The way they were created indicates this, for they have broad hips and a wide fundament to sit upon, keep house, and bear and raise children. In practice, Luther frequently referred to and depended on Katie's intelligence, and he deferred to her authority for his finances and for the running of Luther House. He frequently called her Lord Kate or My Lord, and although she gave birth to 6 children, staying at home to manage Luther House as well as their farm in Zulsdorf meant very little sitting down on her wide fundament. Generally, Katie rose at 4 in the morning and went to bed at 9 at night. Unlike today, the 16th century household was the center of the economy, education, social welfare system, and life in general. The household was the center of all of life. In fact, the words economy and household both come from the same Greek root, oikos. I've already spoken of the prodigious task of making Luther House self-sustaining for a household of 40-plus people. Clearly, Kate's authority over Luther House was no small thing, nor was her dominion over the Luther's finances. Martin wrote, my wife can coax me as often as she wants. She has the entire dominion in her hand, and I yield to it. Luther showed his respect for Kate's wisdom by unofficially putting her on a pastoral search committee, which was a bold move for its time. In July 1530, he wrote her, you are a wise woman, a doctor. I have already indicated 3 candidates to Dr. Palmer, but you are prudent and will make a better choice. Luther's egalitarianism was also evident outside the domestic sphere, and it was firmly rooted in the biblical teaching that God created every individual human being in his image. I'm not sure where this poster came from. It's obviously contemporary today. In arguing for the Bible's teaching on the priesthood of all believers, Luther denied that the Pope, clergy, or any church leader was spiritually superior to any peasant who served God in his or her work. The farmer spreading manure on his field, the printer publishing books, or the mother nursing her infant. He denied a hierarchy of spiritual vocations and taught that all of life is spiritual except for sin. Luther reprimanded parents for pawning off daughters to cloisters. This was common practice in order to earn credit toward salvation and or as a cheap way to dispose of unwanted daughters and save money on their dowries. Luther objected that this practice degraded and imprisoned young women who were given no voice in their decision. Behind this objection is the belief that girls and women are images of God and should have a say in their vocations. Similarly, he believed that the young should have real choice about who they marry. While they should respect their parents' choice for them, parents should never force their children to marry people they could not love. Luther translated the New Testament into vernacular German in 12 weeks so that, quote, every plowboy can read God's word. And working to make the language accessible to peasants, he spent time listening to the language of the common people, to mothers in the home and children in the street. His translation was immensely popular and is credited with uniting the German language for 500 years. I learned last night from Mike's lecture that he actually invented a form of German by putting together, it wasn't...
Hochdeutsch.
Yeah, Hochdeutsch. It hadn't been there before, but he made use of all sorts of dialects in such a way that everyone could understand it and read it. It was extremely popular, and again, united the German language for 500 years. He strongly advocated literacy and education for all children, including girls. That was revolutionary. He wanted everyone to be able to read and interpret the Bible for themselves and not be dependent on the Pope's or the cleric's interpretation. Luther encouraged and defended the Bavarian woman Argula von Grumbach. She was a student of the Bible, a writer, and a reformer, and a defender of other reformers, who was persecuted for stepping outside of woman's sphere by her writing and preaching. According to Saxon law, a married woman, after the death of her husband, is to be given a chair and a skirt. Luther, anticipating that he would die before Katie, was tormented and outraged by this law. And when the topic came up at the table, he said, "Human rights have to be interpreted not according to the letter, but according to the spirit. Therefore, a chair means a house and farmland, and a skirt means livelihood. Let nobody dare to push out a poor widow like a dog." Going against law and common practice, Martin wrote a will, leaving his property to Kate. Unfortunately, he also left her debts. And having the will honored involved a drawn-out battle for Kate because the elector in her region was an enemy of the Reformation and of the Luthers. She had to enlist the help of all of her husband's powerful friends to keep her property and to keep her children and to protect their right to inherit the Luther property. After a protracted battle, she was eventually successful. There's a portrait of the Luther family in the garden with Luther House in the background, probably painted by their friend Lucas Cranach in the 1530s. I read a description of it, but have tried in vain to locate it online. So I put up a 19th century painting of the Luther family at Christmas, which communicates some of the same ideas or some of the same... Okay. What's remarkable in both paintings, the 16th century painting and this 19th century painting, is that Kate is portrayed as a central figure. She's not knitting or sewing in the background, but rather she is there discussing or possibly even arguing with her husband. So this would be her aunt who lived with them, and five of their children. Elizabeth, the baby, the one who died at 8 months, would already have been gone. And it's pretty a funny picture. This looks like he's shooting at the Christmas tree with a crossbow, not one of the children, anyway. In their book, Katharina von Bora, the Markhams write, "As never before in history, women participated in the events of the Reformation rather than remaining silent partners. Through her continuous prayer and her daily interaction with the reformer, Kate offered support and encouragement to Luther as he struggled to hold the movement together. Together with her husband, Kate elevated marriage and motherhood as a reflection of God's natural order of creation." Before concluding, I want to mention one other story which illustrates the kind of marital partnership that was introduced by the Protestant Reformation. Widbrandis Rosenblatt, who lived from 1504 to 1564, outlived four husbands, three of them were reformers, giving birth in total to 11 children and raising more children from her husband's previous marriages. While grieving over the death of her third husband, who died of the plague, Widbrandis was summoned to the deathbed of another reformer's wife, Elizabeth Bucer. We learned about her husband this morning, who was also stricken by the plague. So Elizabeth Bucer was stricken by the plague. As she was dying, she called for this widow to come to her bed, and the dying woman pleaded with Widbrandis to marry her soon-to-be widowed husband. Marilyn Yalom writes, "The deathbed appeal from one woman to another says something about the kind of people they must have been. A wife concerned for the future well-being of her husband, a widow whose reputation for goodness and hard work had preceded her. Widbrandis married Bucer the following year. Bucer wrote of his appreciation for his second wife while still grieving over the death of his first wife, Elizabeth." The story was not unusual. For most of history, marriage has been a practical necessity. Until industrialization, economic work was centered in the home, and children were needed to share the work. Every marriage was a two-person, one-career marriage, with a high degree of interdependence between spouses. When a husband or wife died, which frequently happened, the living spouse had to find a new spouse as soon as possible to share the work and parenting. In closing, I want to summarize three characteristics of marriage that were introduced by the Protestant Reformation, inherited by the Puritans in Europe and America, and still shape many marriages today. On the basis of Scripture, Martin Luther and the Reformation he birthed challenged the Catholic dualism between sacred and secular, or spirit and body, that placed monasticism and celibacy above marriage, family, sexuality, and childbearing. In so doing, the Protestant Reformation dramatically raised the status of marriage and of the wife and helped create a new companionate model of family relations, which included the equality, albeit limited, of partners. Secondly, the Reformation also restored the biblical vision of marriage as the appropriate context for love, sexual attraction, and intimacy, rather than in romanticized adulterous affairs. And third, the Reformation restored a biblical vision of marriage as serving a higher vocation, the glory of God and his kingdom. This explains the very unromantic deathbed arranged marriage I just described to you. These Protestant couples understood themselves as companions and partners in nurturing their children's moral and spiritual development, in creating a Christian community, and in reforming the wider culture. And in welcoming orphans, extended family, traveling teachers, and religious refugees into their homes, often for long periods of time, these families took literally Jesus' teaching that as we welcome the needy and stranger in his name, we welcome Jesus himself. Encouraged to read the Bible in Luther's vernacular translation, they began a tradition of mixed gender Bible study that is still with us. Husbands and wives were partners in reforming the church and society, and they shared the many dangers and hardships that resulted from their religious strife. My final conclusion, last paragraph, Martin Luther was by no means a perfect man. Like all of us, he shared many of his culture's blind spots and had his temperamental flaws. But his rediscovery of long-buried biblical truths started a reformation and sent ripples that have continued to this day. And the principle of reformed and always reforming, semper reformanda, always reforming, should challenge Christians in every age. To end on a provocative note, one blind spot that afflicts many in our churches and culture today is the idolatry of marriage and the devaluing of singleness. Making an idol out of one of God's very good gifts is the surest way to undermine and destroy it. Whether married or single, we are on this earth to serve the higher purpose of God's glory and kingdom. And that's where I'll stop. So. I'm not. Okay.
Coffee and snacks, and we'll gather back here in maybe 20 minutes.
Okay. Sounds good.
None of the cookies have nuts.
Well, that's good to know. Oh, thank you.